All right, friends. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason. Thank you for being part of this, my kind of second installment of my special broadcast while I am convalescing at my home as a result of surgery on my shoulders. God willing, it went well. I'm doing this broadcast actually a month before you're listening to it, probably. If you're listening to it when it comes out and made available to you. But what I did in the last segment is to try to bring you up to date on my autobiography spiritually, I guess simply is a simple way to put it. And I actually haven't gotten into a lot of God stuff here so far. In other words, God's hand in my life and everything. I've just told you from my first person perspective how it is that I became a Christian and the background in circumstances that led up to it, where I was, what I was thinking, and how I turned the corner. One thing I did not mention is that there was, I only hinted at this. And by the way, if you haven't listen to the first installment of this, which will be the last show, I recommend that you do that before you get to this, because this show builds on that one. I mentioned that there were no real apologetics that were part of my my path to coming to Christ. There was nothing that I heard that was some cogent argument for Jesus or the Bible or God or anything like that that turned my head. All I can say is that my mind began to change. As my brother Mark was sharing more and more about the truth of the gospel and my own fallenness, which I was aware of, and we all are. We don't like to think about it, but it's good for us to think about it when we need forgiveness from the things that we've done. And this is what began happening in my life. I became more and more convinced that Christianity was true, that Jesus was who he had claimed to be. And this, of course, was the prayer that I had prayed there at Fort Lewis, Washington in the summer of 1973, just asking God to show himself to me more clearly if he was real. It was a genuine prayer. Maybe the first prayer, that real prayer that I'd ever prayed. I don't know. But in any event, it was one that seemed to trigger a response from God and my own focus on those things until I got to a point where I thought, this is it. This is true. And then I merely sealed that conviction when I prayed the sinner's prayer of sorts on Friday night, September 28, 1973. Now, I mentioned, by the way, Adrian Thatcher and the gal I met in the summer of 73 who had told me about what I came to understand as the Jesus Christ Light and Powerhouse, or JC Light and Powerhouse, or simply Light and Power is the way we used to refer to it. That's what directed me to a Bible study there. I left out one little detail that I wanted to mention to you that that happened in between the time I became a Christian and I discovered the Light and Powerhouse. And that is 2 weeks after I became a Christian. So early October, I went down to Orange County to Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, and my brother and I, along with the young lady that was my high school sweetheart, who I had stayed in contact with, even with the rift in our relationship, and I really wanted her to know the Lord. Now, she had had a religious upbringing also in the Baptist church, but had not been living that way. And in fact, we never talked about spiritual things, as far as I know, in the 6 years or so that we were involved in a relationship. And I wanted her to become a Christian the way I had become a Christian. And so we went to this concert at Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa. I think it was just after the tent days. But many of you know that was the epicenter of the Jesus movement. And that was the beginning of the contemporary Christian music movement. And I don't know who was playing there. It might have even been Chuck Gerard of Love Song, who later had a daughter whose name is Alisa Childers, who's been on this show before, and I've endorsed her book. And I mean, that's kind of a strange kind of connection with the past there. But that night when we got out of the conference or the concert, we were standing by our vehicles in the parking lot, and my former girlfriend prayed that night to commit her life to Christ, and she has been a wonderful Christian ever since. I'm still in touch with her, and her husband came to our wedding in 1998, and it's just been a great thing. Their whole family, many kids, became Christians and served the Lord and in the military, went to Biola. I mean, it was just an unbelievable story all by itself, and I can't get into that because there's not time. But it was a powerful thing that God worked to release me from my emotional attachments in that circumstance, to allow this other relationship, for me emotionally, to allow this other relationship that she had to blossom and develop. And her boyfriend became a Christian. Then they got married, and everything flowed from there. So, but the real turning point for me early on after I became a Christian was when I became associated with this organization or this Christian community called the Jesus Christ Light and Power House. And I mentioned that I had been, I stumbled upon this bookstore, Logos Bookstore in Westwood Village, and met a girl there who I asked about the school, and she actually lived there. She is part of that community, though she worked here in this bookstore. So she is doing both things and putting herself through that school, because there was some modest costs that were involved. After all, we lived there. We ate the food. We were under that roof, but it was modest. It was manageable. But I recently got a note from somebody, and I do not remember this, but the note was from somebody who also ran into me in that same bookstore so many years ago, almost half a century ago, and was a Christian who was faltering in their convictions, and had some kind of a conversation with me in which I strongly encouraged them to pursue the Lord, and which she did. And she is still doing now 45 years later. And it was quite refreshing for me to hear that. She posted something on my Facebook that she had so many years ago in that same little bookstore encountered a brand new Jesus freak Christian, me, Greg Kokel, who knew almost nothing, but took a moment to encourage her, and she is still walking with the Lord. This is not a compliment to me. This is not self-congratulatory. This is God's hand in my life, and in the most vivid example, at least out of the gates, was running into Adrian Thatcher. You know, I speak at a lot of events, and sometimes there's lots and lots of people there, thousands, and sometimes there's almost no one there. Yes, that happens. Does that bother me? No. I like speaking to lots of people. Big groups on the big stage, that's fine. Actually, it's more satisfying with a modest-sized group because I feel like I have a more personal connection with them and I'm making a bigger difference. But even if it's 10 or 15 people that the Lord gives me in that event, it's okay with me. And the reason is because of Adrian Thatcher. That is, I never know when I'm going to be an Adrian Thatcher in someone else's life. I don't know. She had an audience of one. Well, actually, kind of an audience of two. Her real audience of one, the one that mattered, was God. And she has been faithful on the bus with me before the physical audience of one, that was me in the bus. And even though I was trying to pick up on her, she was just interested in letting me know the truth about Jesus. And what she said, or something that she said, stuck. It stuck because God made it stick. And then when the time was ripe, I remembered that, and he orchestrated the circumstances for me to find a person that could get me to this Christian community where I moved into the 1st of February, 1974. And that's set the trajectory the next 2.5 years living at the Light and Power House for my entire Christian life. Because while I was living there, let me back up for a second because I don't want to leave Adrian in the lurch here or in the dust. This established a conviction in me that I never know when what small thing to me that I might do in faithfulness to Christ in the life of another person would be magnified like Jesus' loaves and fishes to have a life-changing impact in someone else's life. Now, that's not just for me. That's for you, too. This is why faithfulness in the small things, not just the big things, is so important. This is why blooming where you're planted is so important. Why the very little thing that God has given you that you can do and be fruitful and productive in that's right in front of you right now at this minute matters. Because of your audience of one in the sense that you are before God being faithful to Him, well done, good and faithful servant kind of thing. And because you never know if that other one, the physical individual in front of you, is going to be one that makes a difference or that's going to bear fruit in some way down the line that you may never have any visibility of. Adrian Thatcher, I guarantee, has no idea what God has done through her moments of faithfulness on that day in the summer of 1973. But my discovering and moving into the Light and Power House was another sea change in my life, because now I was wrapped up in a Christian community. I had Christians around me all the time, which I needed because my moral life was a mess and my personal life was a mess. My character was a mess. My style was a mess. I was a handful. If you think I'm aggressive now or loud or argumentative, I don't know what you think, but I was really, really all of that on steroids at the beginning. And I was young. I was immature. And this is one of the reasons why it was so sweet for me a couple of months into my time at the Light and Power House, meeting different teachers there. Hal Lindsey was one of them. And actually, he didn't hardly ever teach on eschatology. He taught, for example, a whole class on the doctrine of the cross, which was life-changing for me. He wrote a book called The Liberation of Planet Earth, which is all about the cross. And people would leave, students would leave that class in tears. They were so powerfully moved by the message of grace that was communicated through the scriptures that Hal Lindsey talked about at that time. And so my life was deeply influenced by him and other teachers. Dick Day, who discipled Josh McDowell, was one of the teachers there. These were all people, for the most part, who had made a mass exodus from Campus Crusade for Christ, because they all had fallout with Bill Bright. And so they were trained theologically, Dallas Seminary, most of them. And they had street smarts from the crusade days. We learned to use the four laws. We did street witnessing. We did street theater. We did all kinds of things. We had the school there. We learned the Bible. And there was a regular curriculum. And I laid a foundation for me theologically. But most importantly, one of the teachers was a guy who was significantly used by God in Hawaii, a former surfer, still is a surfer, actually, after all these years, and a tennis player, Craig Englert. And he's in books about the Jesus movement written at the time, particularly in the state of Hawaii, where he lived and how God saved him and used him. And now he's there, hired by the crew at the Light and Power House as a teacher, along with a lot of others there that were like the former crusade people. Marshall Foster was there. Marshall's been he's still around doing all kinds of stuff. Some might recognize the name. He was just a couple years older than me, and he was a chaplain over at USC, working with the athletes there on the side. And so there was this unbelievable gathering of very gifted teachers and spiritual leaders, and a bunch of goofy Jesus freaks. and living together and praising the Lord and having body life and studying the Bible and going out and sharing our convictions with those on the street. It was really an unbelievable experience. But Craig Englert was one that I was drawn to. And he, to me, as it turned out, we both were tennis players, and we were playing tennis a lot at the courts right there at UCLA. And so we got to know each other, and we started that spring of 74 a discipleship relationship that lasted over 2 years, and even longer after that in a little less formal fashion. But Craig poured his life into me, along with his wife, Kathy, and that radically changed me. And this is why even today, my heart, just saying here, my heart is not for the lost. People sometimes introduce me there as a man who's got a great heart for the lost. It's just not my heartbeat. I care about the lost. I share my convictions and witness and all that just like other people. But my heartbeat is not for the lost, but it is for the church. It is for discipleship. One of the first verses I ever learned was the things that you've heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, these entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. 2 Timothy 2:2. That's the discipleship passage. I learned that under Craig's tutelage, because we had a group together. Incidentally, one of the guys in that group was a guy that his name was Randy. And we hung out together. We were part of the discipleship group while we were students at the Light and Powerhouse. And he was married, but was still a student there. And that's the case with some. His wife's name was Holly. And a number of years later, Randy sent me some information, and he said, "Hey, I'm involved with a new thing here. You might be interested in." And I really didn't look into it at the time, but later on found out what it was. It was called Promise Keepers, and he was Randy Phillips, and he was the president of Promise Keepers. So there's just a little connection there. You know, we were just some hippies from the Jesus Movement right there very early on in our spiritual lives. But he benefited so much from Craig's input. And for those 2.5 years, I was discipled. Now, one of the things that entailed is this summer, my first summer as a Christian, there was a summer outreach project that Craig was involved with in Waikiki. And he asked me if I wanted to be part of that. I said, "Oh, what, suffering for Christ in Waikiki? All summer long? Oh, okay, you got me." And off we went. And it was a summer outreach project where you have evening events, but you got a job during the day, a part-time job during the day to help pay your expenses and stuff like that. And then you have Bible studies and training and a group meeting, and you go on the beach in Waikiki and with the four spiritual laws, and you talk to people about Christ, and people would get saved. You know, that's just the way it was happening back then. So I was in summer that first, I should say I was in Hawaii that first summer. Oh, one other thing I want to mention, and I didn't mention this. My brother, Mark, is the one who won me to Christ, principally. But my younger brother, 4 years my junior, Dave, he moved out with me, moved in with me, two weeks after I became a Christian, and he had actually prayed to receive Christ a year or so before with Mark, and but not really had any fellowship. And so Dave and I started our walk with Christ together. And Dave moved into the Light and Powerhouse, and Mark moved into the Light and Powerhouse. So we had the three Kokel boys in that community, if you could even imagine that. Okay, they call us the Kook Bros. So we were the three Kook Bros, and part of that. And that summer, 74, I spent 10 weeks working in Hawaii, came back for another year at the Light and Powerhouse. And the following summer, 75, another summer in Hawaii. And this particular time, I wasn't just a participant. I was asked by Craig to be on the staff. And that's when I taught apologetics the first time. Now, how did I know anything about apologetics? Because, first of all, when I became a Christian, I'm walking the streets of Westwood Village, and it was pretty cool. In the weekend, lots of people there and lots of spiritual trips being pushed on the street. We had Hare Krishnas, and we had Tony Alamo Foundation, and we had Jehovah's Witnesses, and we had just all kinds of LDS. There was all kinds of folks that were doing their thing. And so I got into lots of conversations with people, but I didn't know what I was talking about, really. I knew how I had become a Christian, but I knew the basics, but I had to learn some more. And so that's why I would read up some more. And while I was at the Light and Power House, I discovered Francis Schaeffer, and I began to read his trilogy. And actually, when I and this is it may sound like an unusual thing for me to say, but I can actually remember sitting in the Bay Area, which had a lot of bunk beds, where the bulk of the guys that were living in the house were staying. There was maybe 20 or 30 guys, I guess, 15 bunk beds. There was a big, giant Bay Area, you know, and we had a common bathroom kind of deal. I remember sitting there at my desk looking out the window over Westwood Village in the middle of reading one of Francis Schaeffer's books. He has a trilogy, The God Who Is There, He Is There, and He Is Not Silent, and Escape from Reason. And there's a lot of kind of philosophy worked in, and I'd never had any exposure to philosophy before. I didn't know about the epistemological necessity or the ontological necessity or the metaphysical necessity or the moral necessity, and these were all concepts that he dealt with in his work. And it really formed my thinking as a young Christian. And I remember sitting there at that desk, looking out the window, reflecting on what I was reading. And here's the thought that came to my mind. Hey, this stuff, this Christianity stuff, this thing that I've given my life to, this stuff is really true. I mean, really, really true. Like deeply and profoundly true. Like I can really, really count on it. And that was the first time I'd really gotten anything substantive regarding what might be called apologetics that was bolstering the conviction I had by the Holy Spirit of the truth of Christianity. I also remember there was a time when Josh McDowell was in town and he gave a lecture on campus at UCLA. And I went to that lecture, and I can picture him in my mind's eye standing there after the lecture in the auditorium with a group of people surrounding him as he's answering questions. He was great. And that was another little touchstone. And it's interesting now that not only do I know Josh and have had lots of interactions with him over the years, but his son, Sean, is a dear friend of mine. In fact, he spent many days and many evenings at our home as part of a discipleship group that I led when I was doing my master's work, and he was too, in philosophy at Talbot. But that's just a funny little thing as things come around. Did I plan that? No, it just kind of happened. What I did plan to do, and this is part of the influence of Craig in my life, is to repeat what he did, because discipleship is not finished until the ones you disciple are discipling others. And that I got from the Master Plan of Evangelism by Robert Coleman, which is a profound and still a best-selling book. And I encourage you to read that because it identifies how Jesus planned to reach the world, not by giving bunches of big talks, but by pouring his life into 12 individuals who then poured their lives into others, who then poured their lives into others. That's the calculus of the discipleship approach. And so I've had many, many groups over the years, and Sean was just part of one, most of my staffers. I'm looking at Amy here on the screen, and she was in one of those groups years ago, and now she's here on our staff and our team. So this is what is my heartbeat about, and this is what influences my role with Stand to Reason and how I engage you as a follower of Jesus. A lot of non-Christians are listening in, and I'm glad you're here, but I'm not principally trying to win you over. God can take care of that. I'm going to garden in your life a little bit. My intent is to build the Christian. That's why the first three words of Stand to Reason's mission are, we train Christians. That's our target group. Okay. So for those 2.5 years at the Light and Power House, I was trained and influenced not just by Craig Englert, but by Marshall Foster and Dick Day and Hal Lindsey and Bill Counts and a host of others that were part of Tom Brewer, part of that enterprise. Tom Brewer is the one who introduced me to Francis Schaeffer. And he was also the one who said something that I've said many times since then, that Jesus is not the bridge over troubled waters, but He can pull you through the troubled waters if you can stand the tow. That's Tom Brewer in My Life early on. Mark Arrington, he taught the Old Testament, and from Mark's teaching of B in the Old Testament eventually came the Bible Fast Forward, which you can get now at Stand to Reason. Profound influence in my life by those men who were so faithful. So those following two summers, 73, make that 74 and 75, I worked in Hawaii, Summer Outreach Project. The second time I was a staff member and I taught groups. And then we went back to the Light and Powers for my last year. And this would be 75, 76. And that Bible study that I stumbled upon a couple of years before, my first Bible study that I ever went to, and I continued going there and then moved into that house. Well, that last year at the Light and Power House, I was assigned to be like the MC for that particular enterprise. And so you welcome everybody and say hi, you know, glad you're here. You make some announcements that have to do with the community and introduce some music. We usually had somebody playing guitars. Sometimes the music was Paul Reiser and a young lady named Terry, who he later married. Paul was a med student there at UCLA and later on graduated. And he is now my personal doctor, as it turns out, all these years later. And he is also the one who's authored all the med books for Focus on the Family. You know, so this is another thing that came out of that crazy group of people at the Light and Powerhouse. But it turned out, since I'm doing that, I'm standing in front of the audience and kind of getting a little bit more experience with kind of interacting with audiences and public speaking and that kind of thing. That was good for me, but it wasn't much. I'm just, hi, welcome, here's Hal kind of thing. You know, here's the music, here's Hal. It turned out in the spring of that year, Hal Lindsey didn't show up. All the people were there. Everybody else showed up, but Hal didn't show up. I don't know what happened. Frankly, I can't recall, but he wasn't there. I'm the MC, okay? So I get on the phone and call one of the other teachers, and I say, what am I going to do? Hal's not here. All these people are here. They're waiting to hear a teaching. And Linus Morris said to me, you teach. Huh? I'm just a long-haired hippie in bib overalls here, you know, Jesus freak. You want me to teach all these people who came to hear the best-selling author of the entire decade? Yeah, go ahead, you teach. Now, it turned out that as part of the training there, I had put together a little teaching out of Philippians chapter 1 for a class, and we practiced it in the class, so I still had those notes. So I said, all right. And I got up, made my announcements. We have the special music. And then I said to the audience, I said very calmly, I mean, I was definitely faking it at this point, but I just said very calmly, Hal's not here tonight. I'll be doing the teaching. Please turn in your Bibles to Philippians chapter 1. And a magical thing happened. People opened their Bibles to Philippians chapter 1. Dutifully, trusting I knew what I was doing. And as it turned out, it worked out nicely. But I have to tell you, and this is one of the things that I teach in public speaking now, people are happy to be led if you lead. And there, I didn't say, golly gee whiz, I don't know nothing, but I got to do this and aw shucks, but let's take a shot at it, you know, and make them uncomfortable. No, I just stepped out and did it, and it worked out. It worked out okay. And there was another little detail that resulted from that serendipitous event that night. Because I was planning a mission trip that summer, in a couple of months, to go to Europe to work with Christians behind what was then the Iron Curtain. Remember, this is 1976. And I explained to the group during the announcement phase that this is what we were doing. We were praying for our support, and we needed a car. As it turned out, we purchased a car in Switzerland. There were four of us. And then we traveled through Western Europe a bit and then crossed the border in Hungary, and then into Romania, and then into the Soviet Union, the Ukraine, and Moldavia, and then Ukraine, and then into Poland, and then into DDR, East Germany at the time, then into Berlin, then back into DDR, then into Czechoslovakia, and then into Austria. And that's after we'd gone to Yugoslavia. So basically, we had six or seven communist countries, depending on how you count Yugoslavia. And we were going to do this to help Christians behind the Iron Curtain. Our goal wasn't to smuggle Bibles so much as to make contacts and build a network and help those who are suffering terribly as a result of communist, socialist, atheistic oppression. So I mentioned that we're going to do that, and then I went on with my teaching. As it turned out, I found out later that somebody wrote a check for the car that night. Well, that was just a coincidence, wasn't it? What was I doing? I was blooming where I was planted. Did I plan to teach then? No. But that was the very first time I had ever taught the Bible. I had given it some of these evangelistic things, a couple of small evangelistic messages, but I'd never opened the Bible to a passage and tried to teach what the Bible said. And the first time I ever taught the Bible was when I filled in for Al Lindsey, and I didn't know hardly anything. But I knew enough to pass something on, and God honored that. And then not only did he honor it in the teaching because I was trying to be faithful with what I had, but then this check came in, and when we got to Switzerland, we bought a car. Now, I spent that summer of 1973 in Europe. We had 5.5 weeks in the East, and there were four of us, a married couple, and a guy named Lance. He had just graduated from Fuller Seminary. And we just got connected through Linus Morris, who set this thing up. And we had our plan for the 3.5 weeks. Now, we mostly slept in for much of the time as we traveled, especially in Eastern Europe. We were finding camping plotses and sleeping in a tent. So Lance and I had a tent together. So for weeks and weeks, Lance and I were shoulder to shoulder in sleeping bags in a small pup tent, okay? Well, this is the Lance that I spent the summer with in 1976 that went on to do other things. And eventually, when Pastor John Wimber died, founder of the Anaheim Vineyard, Lance took over for John Wimber. So Lance Pitlick is now the pastor of the Anaheim Vineyard, absolutely marvelous, significant going concern here in Southern California, influencing churches all over the country. Lance Pitlick. God just used him in that wonderful way. When I got back, I decided to finally get my bachelor's degree. I'd been jumping all around. It had bits and pieces of it. So I went to Azusa Pacific, what was a college then, and finished my bachelor's degree in the Bible. Now I switched my interests, and then I did a year of graduate work and decided, well, I don't want to do this anymore. I got to make some money. And so I joined my brothers here in Southern California as carpenters, and I worked for a carpenter for about 5 years, a finished carpenter, and I installed kitchens, mostly modular kitchen cabinets, high-end. I worked a lot in Beverly Hills and places like that. And meantime, attached myself to Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach. And this was the church that Craig Englert, my discipler, had now transferred to and was on staff at. He was a staff pastor there. And so I hung out there, and I actually was there very early. It was a bigger church now, but I had started going there when there were just a very, very small group of people, mostly surfers from the South Bay of the Los Angeles area. And it was one of those surfer churches like Calvary Chapel. You know, you can come with your bathing suit and your flip-flops and cover with sand if you wanted to. Whoever will may come. And that was part of the Jesus Movement ethic. And that church grew and grew and grew, and I attached myself there. I got to speak there when I returned from Eastern Europe and did some other things there. And I also started getting invitations to speak around the South Bay and, indeed, in Washington, D.C., because I had a friend whose father was a congressman, and she put together their 6 months or actually summer of 76, so Christmas at time, 1976. So it was just a few months after I got back from Eastern Europe. And I did a whole bunch of things there. I spoke to church groups. I spoke on radio shows and did a lot of stuff there. So what am I doing now? I'm still just kind of getting my feet wet. just doing whatever I could do. Wherever I had an opportunity, I did it. And meanwhile, I'm involved at Hope Chapel. I'm teaching in my local church when I have a chance, Bible studies here and there, local community churches in the area were asking me to speak to singles groups because I was single for another 20 years, as it turned out. And so I did that for 5 years, working as a carpenter and ministering in the evenings wherever I was able to do that. I took every single opportunity that I was offered to speak or to teach or do a Bible study. And I was discipling at that time. I had a group of young men that I was discipling, okay? And then actually larger young women Christian women were added to it. So it was a mixed group. But in 1982, I decided I needed a change of scenery. I had had a rough relationship end on me, and I just needed to get out of the country. And so I volunteered with Food for the Hungry International to be a worker for them in Thailand. Now, Thailand was unique at this time, 1982, because on the eastern border of Thailand, western border of Cambodia, there were a series of camps that had sprung up because of the exodus of refugees from the Cambodian Holocaust from 1975 to 1979, the Khmer Rouge, the Pol Pot, you know about that. And it was a terrible thing that happened to them. The population went from 4 million to 2 million people, and the country was cut in half by domestic terrorism. And when the Vietnamese invaded from the east to attack the Khmer Rouge, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people fled across the border into Thailand, creating a refugee crisis there in 79, 80, 81. And by the time I got there at 82, the things had eased up quite a bit. But I was working in a refugee camp. Sakeo had 18,250 refugees in it, and it was my job to feed every single one of them. And there was a program there that I stepped into about purchasing food, warehousing food, and distributing it in this camp called Sakeo. And I was there for 7 months in one of the most meaningful experiences of my life. Now, yes, I had that 3.5 weeks behind the Iron Curtain. That was unbelievable. And by the way, during that time in the Iron Curtain, we got through, I mentioned Hungary and Romania. When we got to the Soviet Union, that was different because they found the Bibles that we had in our baggage. We weren't hiding them anywhere, but they found them and they got really upset. And after they sequestered us. We were interrogated for 15 hours. They pulled our car completely apart, have it up in the rack, pulling the fender, all kinds of things out, dismantling, trying to find secret compartments. And then they let us continue meeting with the Christians there. We went on, but we had to sign a statement, which was really curious because the reason they said that we couldn't bring Bibles into the Soviet Union was because they had separation of church and state. That was it. Well, wait a minute. What does that have to do with us bringing Bibles in? Well, we have all the Bibles we need. This is what they told us. We print Bibles here in the Soviet Union. Oh, okay. Well, then you shouldn't have any trouble bringing. No, you can't bring that in. It's anti-communist propaganda. Now, maybe some of you made the connection there already. Wait a minute. If you print Bibles here, yes, we do. We have all the Bibles we need. Christians have everything they need. But you won't let us bring these Bibles in. No, you can't. Why not? Because it's anti-communist propaganda. So what you're saying is, and we asked them this question, that you print anti-communist propaganda right here in your own country when you print the Bibles. And then came the mystical, enigmatic, no, you don't understand. We have separation of church and state here in the Soviet Union. I'm not kidding you. Actually, there's a segment of this in the book on tactics. And so we joked around afterwards. What they're trying to do is separate the church right out of the state. Now, this was 1976. Okay, we are like 40 years removed from that. Plus, and it's ironic, isn't it, how similar the circumstances have become here in this country. I've reflected on that many, many times. Who'd have thunk back then, as we're accosted at the border, that so many of the restrictions that the Soviet Union had in place under the pretense of separation of church and state that functioned to simply oppress Christians, how many of those restrictions we see growing in this country as well. Another issue, of course, but something I reflect on frequently. In any event, there are a lot of other stories I can tell you about what happened there in the Soviet Union and in the other communist countries. I just leave that behind. It was a chapter in my life that was unbelievable. And again, it was an opportunity for me to do something fruitful. It presented itself. I said, I got the time. I can do this. Why not? And another step forward. Was I going to be a full-time missionary behind the Iron Curtain? No, I had no intentions about that, but it was something to do for that summer. And 3.5 months gone, 5.5 weeks behind the Iron Curtain, I came into West Berlin from East Berlin, which is weird. I crossed over the Iron Curtain to get into that island of freedom known as West Berlin. But anyway, I digress because I'd left that out of that section. Now in 1982, I'm in Thailand and I'm working in this refugee camp. Again, taking opportunity for something I could do. Didn't know where that was going to lead, but I worked there for 7 months and came back to my church. And when I came back to my church, I took up eventually a position there as an associate pastor at Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach. And it was a magnificent experience that I led in Thailand. I lived in the country. I worked in a refugee camp. I lived in a little clapboard house, you know, that had some running water, no hot water. It didn't have a flush toilet. It had a Thai style toilet. You flush it yourself with a big bowl of water, and you know, snakes would come into the house and banded crates and whatever. It just green pit vipers. Water buffalo walking the roads. It was really, really adventuresome for me and a great experience to help those beleaguered people out, the Cambodian people known as the Khmer. But when I got back, there was a little downtime for me, and I finally ended up taking a staff position at Hope Chapel. And what I did there is I was a writer for them. I did utility writing, so you have to write announcements or things like that. That was my job. And I also, we started a magazine called The Magazine of Hope, where we had some articles in it, announcements, and it came out once a month to serve our constituents, the people in our church. Plus, I started a program, or I picked up one that had been started by Craig Englert, called the Hope Chapel Ministry Institute. Now, he had actually gone to Hawaii to start a church there in Kihei, Hope Chapel Kihei, which has grown significantly, and I think he's just now retired after about 30 years there. And it's a huge light in that dark place, the state of Hawaii. A lot of Christians there, but a lot of darkness there as well. And so I did this job for a number of years, and while I was there, a couple of things happened. First of all, I started being a guest at a program, a radio program, that was called Religion on the Line. Now, Religion on the Line is a secular program that was on the ABC affiliate here in Los Angeles, Sunday nights from 10 to midnight. And it was hosted by a guy named Dennis Prager. And it was a local show. And he had a priest and a rabbi and a minister that would be guests on the show, and he was Jewish himself, and the Protestant minister and the priest and the rabbi, the four of them would mix it up on religious topics, no commercial interruptions, taking callers for those 2 hours. And somebody called me, and I remember the time precisely. I remember the event. It's pictured clearly in my mind. I was watching TV, eating a piece of pizza. My phone rang. I picked up the phone in one hand. I had a piece of pizza in the other hand. And this person says, do you mind if I put your name in as a pastor to be considered to be on the radio show Religion on the Line? The ABC affiliate there. I didn't know what it was. I said, sure, why not? Okay. A couple of days later, I get a call from Religion and Media. They say, can you come down and be on this show with a rabbi, a priest, and the Jewish Dennis Prager, and you're going to represent Protestant Christianity. Well, now, I said yes, of course. Why? Because I was blooming where I was planted. But I was scared Because even though I've been teaching apologetics and talking about this, and even in my own church giving talks that I still give at Stand to Reason, now I had to go face-to-face, head-to-head with people who would disagree with me significantly on theological topics. And even though we were all part of a religious crowd and all theists in that setting, although occasionally they'd have an atheist that would come in, Gordon Stein, now gone, but very well-known outspoken atheist, was a guest once when I was there. Even so, most of them that were on our broad team, I was representing evangelical Christianity. And that means I wasn't going to be able to agree with the Jewish rabbi or Dennis Prager in his particular view of ethics as a source of salvation, or even the Roman Catholic priest on much of what we talked about, because I was an exclusivist. And I believe that Jesus was the only way of salvation, and you had to believe in him in order to be saved, which the Roman Catholic guest did not believe, which stunned me, having been raised in that church. But even so, I realize I'm in a kind of hostile territory when it comes to these kinds of issues, salvation issues. I'm on my own. And these guys are pros. They've been around the block a bunch of times. How am I going to do here? So I pled with my church for prayer. And I learned, too, and my brother, who was familiar with the program, my brother Mark, told me this. Dennis is a really fair guy. He's not going to beat you up. He's not going to make you feel bad and look ridiculous, but he's going to hold your feet to the fire on your views, okay? And he's really sharp, which all of that was true. So I went the first night, and I survived. And then they asked me back again, and I survived again, and they asked me back again. I think 24 times I was on that program. And not only that, CBS TV had another program like it for a half an hour called Today's Religion. It was really early in the morning, and it was a TV program, but I was on that a number of times as well. And that, by the way, not only taught me how to maneuver in a crossfire kind of situation, okay, it gave me experience on the radio. It gave me the confidence that the things that I had been teaching people could really compete in it when I was in the hot seat, so to speak. But it also introduced me to a man who I've had an extended friendship with for many, many years, Dennis Prager. And now he's got a national show. Now he's got a online product that gets a billion, yes, that's with a B, views every single year, called PragerU. I've actually guested on PragerU and done an event like that. And so I have been able to have a role in his life. I don't have the big hammer that he has with this national radio audience, but I have access to him and we have a friendship. And so there's been opportunity for me to be able to influence his life and his thinking as well. And we still text actually during his show, and sometimes he'll announce something on the show that I've said that he thought was fruitful. So through him, I get to reach this larger audience. This I never planned on. I never expected anything like this would come of it. I just saw an opportunity. I'm eating pizza. Shall I put your name on the list? Yeah, go ahead. And all of a sudden, I get scheduled. And then again and again and again. And I will tell you something. These things would happen at 10 o'clock on Sunday night. And sometimes I was teaching that weekend at our services, and we had five services a weekend for that period of time. We had one on Friday night. We had two on Saturday night. We had three on Sunday morning. And then Sunday night, I'm wasted, right? But I've got to get in my vehicle and drive to the ABC studios to get beaten up by a bunch of people who don't agree with what I believe in. And I promise you, I would check in at KBC there in the dark of night, and I'd be all by myself, and I'd walk down the empty hallway towards the green room, and I can picture myself right now turning, leaning, and putting my head against the wall and saying to myself, what are you doing here? What are you doing here? Well, I'll tell you what I was doing. I was being faithful in the moment to bloom where I was planted and do the best I can. Now, you can see, though I never planned all of these series of events with Religion on the Line, and I never planned the radio part. A few years later, in 1990, actually it was 1989, I got a call from the local Christian station, KBRT, and they asked me if I wanted to test for a radio show, 3 hours Saturday, 3 hours Sunday. And I said, okay. And so even though I was working the rest of the week at my church as an associate pastor doing the things I do there and teaching that educational program and writing the stuff for them, still at the same time, I was willing to test for this. And I tested and they gave me a show. And so I became a broadcaster in the second largest radio market in the country, Los Angeles, during, well, Strive Time, but it was weekends, but still a significant spot. And I did that for 3 years. And because now I'm building my name recognition, I'm getting more opportunities to speak outside of my own church, which I did. Then I get an opportunity to speak at a local crisis pregnancy center right here in the Thousand Oaks area. A friend of mine from the Light and Powerhouse days, gee, go figure, was directing that center. She asked, would I come out and do their fundraiser, be the keynote for their fundraiser? I said, yes, I'd be willing to do that. She said, and by the way, I have a girl I'd like you to meet if you're open to a blind date. I said, okay. And I went there to do the teaching, and the teaching was the death of humanness. It was a talk, first time I'd ever talked at an event like that, but that was the talk that Focus on the Family picked up about 3 years later and played on their network over two shows dealing with the abortion issue. And that was the night that I met Stees Melberg, who I ended up marrying 5 years later, which means all our girlfriends are really mad at me because it took so long to do. But then that was the fall of 92. And so now I'm doing this radio stuff. I'm doing stuff at my local church. I'm taking the opportunities that I have. And do you see how all of these things are kind of building kind of a curriculum vitae of sorts that I'm not intending on building? Oh, incidentally, I started also working on a master's degree in apologetics. I thought, what the heck? I like apologetics. There's one that's available here at Simon Greenleaf University. I'll just start taking classes. That was the early 90s, and by 1994, I'd graduated. I had a master's in apologetics. But something else was going on, too, at the same time, and that was that in the spring of 93, I went to India to be part of a missions thing that my church was doing. I met a guy named Bobby Gupta, and everybody else was going out to tribal things in the country, and I was speaking at universities in Madras, India. And Bobby Gupta, who ran the Hindustan Bible Institute, said, you got to start something. You got to start an organization. He was on Ravi Zacharias's first board. He helped Ravi start his organization. You got to do the kind of thing that Ravi's doing. Now, I brushed it off, but when I got back to the States a few weeks later, he came and visited the States. We had breakfast. Then he really put his boot in my bottom. And he said, as a matter of stewardship, you need to do this. And so I talked with some friends. And at that time, I was friend with a young lady named Melinda Penner, because she was going to our church and she was actually helping me a lot with the classes that I was teaching at Hope Chapel Ministry Institute. And Melinda was a tremendous aid because she was a school teacher, but she had a theological education and she was very organized. And I said, if I'm going to do something like this, I need your help. And so we got together with a group of people one night at my home, and spiritual advisors, including my brother Mark, was there to get their opinion about what they thought. They gave me a tentative go-ahead. We're excited, but we're not sure what we're excited about because all my ideas were half-baked. So I went back to the drawing board, and I put together something more concise. And then I met with a whole bunch of people, like 60 or 70 people who had been following me on radio and people in my church and people who I could contact. And I invited them to Hope Chapel on May 1st, 1993. And I said, I got this idea. I gave this talk. I still have the tape for that. In fact, some of you have probably heard it. It's available. This thing is where I want to try to help Christians to think more carefully about their faith and to make my contribution as a speaker and a Christian thinker. Now, we didn't have the ambassador idea yet. We didn't have knowledge, wisdom, character. We didn't have tactics in play. This was just a rudimentary effort, but this effort was called Stand to Reason. And after I gave my presentation, I gave everybody a blank sheet of paper. I said, here's two things I want to know from you. Thumbs up or thumbs down. What is your opinion about me making this move out of my role at the church there, Hope Chapel Hermosa Beach, and into a full-time role as president of this new organization, Stand to Reason? And secondly, if you got a thumbs up, I want to know how much money you want to put down to help us to start it. Everybody gave a thumbs up. Every single person. Now, everybody didn't put the cash down, but over the next couple of weeks, we had about $15,000 or $16,000 or $17,000 that came in that allowed us to do the legal work. And then I slowly began to transition out of Hope Chapel, and Melinda began to transition in to Hope Chapel part-time to do the work I was doing there and in part-time to help me with Stand to Reason while I was full-time with Stand to Reason. And Hope Chapel gave us a room in the very, very back of the building. This was like no windows in this room. That's how far back it was. But that's, and we gathered a number of volunteers, and we started building a core of donors and supporters, and we started to build our legacy that continues now 27 plus years later, 18 workers at STR, four speakers right now, and other speakers that have gone from us, through us, people like Scott Klusendorf at Life Training Institute and Brett Kunkel over at Maven, and Alan Schliemann, who is still with us now, Stephen Wagner with Justice for All now, J. Warner Wallace with Cold Case Christianity. These are all people that were on our team, and we still have our team in residence now, and we may lose some of them sometime in the future, but God keeps multiplying this. Here's what I want you to see. I never planned any of this. I never planned any of this. Even when we planned Stand to Reason, I didn't think of it like this. I just wanted to be a full-time speaker, and I needed somebody to help me out, a little money to keep me going. But my base commitment was, bloom where you're planted. Be a student of your craft. Take the things that you've got, use them, and get better at them as God moves them forward. So that's the history, these last two shows, that has led us to this spot of productivity for the kingdom. It's not been easy. It's been work. It's always work. And I'm not led by the Spirit. I don't have God talking to me all the time. He never talks to me. What I try to do is take what he has said in his word and apply it faithfully to my life. And even in the small things that I encounter, to be faithful in those things. And that's been the secret, if there is a secret, to God prospering my efforts over the last nearly now 47 years as a follower of Christ. I hope that what I've offered is an encouragement to you, is instructive to you, as it's been encouraging and instructive to me. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven.